listening to the Key of Awesome Music podcast, brought to you by me, Jim Gavin. Key of Awesome Music was established back in 2011 as a way to further protect and promote the music that I wrote as a solo artist, as well as some of the other bands that I was in the past. And that has since grown into representing 10 artists' music that have either gone under the radar or have not been noticed for one reason or another, and are just awesome, awesome musicians and storytellers through song. In the late winter and early spring of 2018, Key of Awesome Music was given the opportunity to further expand its horizons as well as further impact people in a positive way using music as a tool to do so. From one-on-one sessions on guitar, piano, bass, ukulele, percussion, and vocals, to group sessions at developmental and physically disabled day programs, to interactive live performances at nursing homes and assisted living facilities, we are fortunate and blessed to be able to provide a mission-based music service for people in a time of need. Right now, we are reaching out to drug and alcohol counseling centers, prisons, at-risk youth, homeless shelters, soup kitchens, mental health organizations, and anywhere else we can think of where coming in to do a music program would best serve and support the individuals that you serve and support. If this sounds like something you are interested in, please feel free to reach out to us at jim.gavin@gmail.com. That is jim.gaven@gmail.com. Also, you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/keyofawesomemusic. That's facebook.com/keyofawesomemusic. We also have a Patreon page set up so that we can go into some of these places and not affect their bottom line. If you are looking to donate to a worthy cause or something a little different outside of the box and you're having trouble doing so, this would be a great opportunity to give back to the community and using music as a means to help people. Feel free to go to www.patreon.com/JimGavin. That's patreon.com/JimGaven. Thank you for all of the love and support. Trust me, it is greatly appreciated. From the bottom of my heart, thank you, thank you, thank you. This is Jim Gavin from the Key of Awesome Music, improving the quality of life through music.
To find out there's nothing all right now to ease your mind. Sit back, relax, there is no rush, no need to speed things up. All we have is time to think about the future, forget about the past. Time to figure out a way to make this moment you'll see, we're slowly coming. Time. Sunsets, I won't let you forget that I need you. Spring comes and spring goes, forever you will know that I love you. Sunrise, sunsets, I won't let you forget that I need you. Spring comes and spring goes, forever you will know that I love you.
Hey everybody, this is Jim Gavin coming at you from the Key of Awesome Music, where we talk about all things awesome with an especially a focus on music. All right, so today's topic, something a little different, something I learned a lot about in the whole process of kind of researching this topic, ethnomusicology. Definition of it, the study of music from the cultural and social aspects of the people who make it. The study of music that is outside the European art tradition, or the study of music in a socio-cultural context. Very interesting. Kind of taking where music originates from and seeing how it plays out in that culture, see if the environment sort of affects the music infects the environment, kind of a hodgepodge of everything. Really interesting. Just something I was kind of getting more into and learning about, just kind of doing some research articles and wanted to share this with you. It's really cool. So just a little bit of a background on it. The word was coined in 1955 by the Dutch musicologist Jaap Kunst in the study of music in the context of its time and place, because like any other art, music is influenced by the society and culture of its creation. For this reason, the study of Western music within its social and cultural context is also considered to be ethnomusicology, like we're talking about. And as music writer Paula Kerman described in her 1997 essay, An Introduction to Ethnomusicology, the discipline is best understood as the fusion of musicology and anthropology. Very, very neat kind of stuff. I could go down the rabbit hole with this, over kind of getting really into the weeds, but I'm going to try not to for the sake of brevity and for the sake of not boring you to death. So just some little other tidbits about it. Ethnomusicology has been supported by the field of world music. The music may be and often is influenced by foreign, usually American popular music, but is nevertheless unmistakably rooted in its own culture. Musicians and ethnomusicologists
from the developed world, particularly America and Europe, often work with local musicians to preserve and popularize their work so it's not lost in a homogenized global culture. So, in order to go a little bit into what the heck, who can become an ethnomusicologist, right? And who ends up becoming one? Like I said briefly, it originated from musicology, which is basically the study of music, interestingly enough. Simple, right? And sort of where people are from, the anthropology, right? So musicology and anthropology combined. In doing the research I did for this topic, I found a ton of ethnomusicologists, but I'm only going to share three of them with you, the highlighted ones. So the highlighted ones that I had found, and it's actually a field we talked about from the early 1900s, before people kind of knew what ethnomusicology was. There were a few people that were doing it already, didn't have a term for it yet. Hence, that's why Jaap Kunst came up with it in 1955. People were doing it beforehand, not realizing, well, this is something a little different than just musicology and anthropology. So here we go. David Herbert is one. He was born in 1972. He's kind of like your modern day ethnomusicologist. He's only 46 years old right now, so fairly young in the grand scheme of things. He's a musicologist and comparative educationist employed as a professor of music at Western Norway University of Applied Sciences in Bergen, Norway. He leads the Grieg Academy Music Education Research Group. He's contributed to the fields of music education, ethnomusicology, sociomusicology, comparative education, and East Asian studies. He serves on editorial boards of several scholarly journals, led the historical ethnomusicology group of the Society for Ethnomusicology, of which he's a life member, in 2009-2011, and was editor of the 25th anniversary proceedings of the Nordic Association for Japanese and Korean Studies. His interest in global music historiography developed as he explored such topics as how European music was adopted in Japan and how the American genres of jazz and rock music ironically struggled to gain acceptance in American schools. In 2014, he produced a book with Jonathan McCollum entitled Theory and Method in Historical Ethnomusicology. Through use of a broad spectrum of geocultural examples, the volume includes several engaging strategies for using and writing about history in order to understand the world's musics. Really cool. And the ethnomusicologists Keith Howard, Daniel Newman, and Judah Cohen contributed chapters as well. He now edits a book series in this field with Jonathan McCollum for Roman and Littlefield Press, the Lexington series in Historical Ethnomusicology, Deep Soundings. Thought it'd be kind of neat to share somebody who's modern. I found a lot of people who had already died or are very old. And so somebody who's more on the modern day scheme of this. Second person is Mantle Hood, who's an American ethnomusicologist. Among other areas, he specialized in studying Gamelian music from Indonesia. He pioneered in the 1950s and 60s a new approach to the study of music and the creation of the first American university program devoted to strictly ethnomusicology at UCLA. He also founded the Institute for Ethnomusicology at the college in 1960. UCLA quickly became an important American hub of this rapidly developing field. His work spawned a legion of teachers and leaders of more than 100 Gamelan groups in the United States today. He explained ethnomusicology as being the study of music wherever and whenever. His approach of learning the songs you are studying, which was a novel concept at the time, enables the researcher to, in some manner, learn about music from the inside, quote unquote, and thereby experience its technical, conceptual, and aesthetic challenges. The student is also able to better connect socially within the community being studied and have better access to the community's rituals and performances. It's been an important ethnomusicological research tool ever since. So it's interesting how this wasn't in effect before, how important it was to actually learn how to play the songs that you're studying. I guess people hadn't thought of that before. They just studied it. They didn't think about actually learning it on an instrument and the different intricacies and how difficult some of the different world music is. It's not just your standard four chord progressions like you have in pop music and many other genres that we have in the United States that would fall within that vein. And the third one we have here, and if arguably not the most popular ethnomusicologist, is a woman by the name of Frances Teresa Densmore. She lived to be 90 years old and died in 1957. So just as this field was given a technical term, she passed away. She was an American anthropologist and ethnographer born in Minnesota. Known for her love of Native American music and culture in modern terms, she may be described as an ethnomusicologist. As a child, she developed an appreciation of music by listening to the nearby Dakota Indians. She studied music at Oberlin College for 3 years, helped preserve their culture in a time when government policy was to encourage Native Americans to adopt Western customs. She was quite a rebel and an amazing person to do so for those people. She began recording music officially for the Smithsonian Institution's Bureau of American Ethnology in 1907. Crazy. In 50 plus years of studying and preserving American Indian music, she collected thousands of recordings. Many of the recordings she made are in the Library of Congress. Super impressive, to say the least. Some of the tribes she worked with include the Chippewa, the Mandan, the Hidatsa, the Sioux, the Northern Pawnee of Oklahoma, the Papago of Arizona, Indians of Washington and British Columbia, Winnebago and Menominee of Wisconsin, the Pueblo Indians of the Southwest, the Seminoles of Florida, and even the Kuna Indians of Panama. She wrote The Indians and Their Music in 1926, and between 1910 and 1957, when she passed away, she published 14 book-length bulletins for the Smithsonian. Very impressive. Each describing the musical practices and repertoires of a different Native American group. So why do we care so much about this particular study of music? Because it matters. It matters where music that is created comes from and who creates it. It's a part of history. It's a part of a culture. It gives us a glimpse into what was going on at the time and where it was going on. I've always been interested in why a band sounds like they do. Mind you, the study is mainly done on what's considered popular music, buzz, radio airplay, and album record sales, not music that would have fallen under the radar or underground, so to speak. Is it because of where they're from, the band? The grunge sound coming from bands like Nirvana, Soundgarden, and Pearl Jam, because they're all based around Seattle, and that city is known for having more rainy or overcast days than most in the USA, therefore making for a darker, dirtier sounding type of music? The blues coming from the Deep South and moving up to Chicago because of the life situations of the men and women who created it, mostly African Americans who were mistreated from the 1860s onward with slavery, bigotry, and segregation, and the need to express themselves in a creative way? Maybe. Is reggae music the way it is, upbeat and fun sounding like a party, because it draws most of its inspiration from Jamaica and the Caribbean, which is known for great weather and beautiful surroundings? Is salsa music the same way, because it draws a lot from Central and South America, where the local inhabitants are all about family, friendship, and gathering people together as if they are having a party? Did the Grateful Dead sound the way they did because they were doing their thing in the 60s and 70s in San Francisco, the epicenter for the hippie movement and jam bands, or because that's what just quote-unquote moved them? Much like the protest songs of the same era, were they because that's what singer-songwriters or bands felt like doing, or was it more because of the peace message they wanted to spread, which was 100% against the Vietnam War? A group like Peter, Paul, and Mary are a perfect example of this. I used to pay attention to this a lot in my early 20s. In the early 2000s, especially with bands in the emo or pop-punk scene, it seemed like any band who was signed to Drive Thru Records or considered pop-punk or emo was hand-selected for songs that skateboarders would skate along to. Warped Tour, Skate and Surf Festival, and Bamboozled were all the rage. Lineups like The Early November, Census Fail, Something Corporate, Alistair, Brand New, Taking Back Sunday, My Chemical Romance, Sum 41, Blink-182, Saves the Day, Green Day, and All American Rejects graced the stages of these tours. At that time, skateboarding seemed like it was an all-time high with the advent of TRL and MTV and gaming consoles like PlayStation for anything Tony Hawk. It was the perfect combination of music and sport. It wasn't just with these types of bands either. It was with solo artists and any other type of band. I've always been fascinated where bands are from and why they sound the way they do. Is it because of a geographical spot on the map? Does environment really play a role in this? The makeup of the band members' personalities and tendencies, a little bit of both, or just a random occurrence or coincidence? I think it has to do with the former two and not the latter one. You can make correlations to go down the rabbit hole quite a bit more into this field of research, but the long story short is it's infinitely interesting and an area that will only grow in popularity over time. I am very interested to see where it is 10 years from now. So that's it for today. Hope you learned a little bit of something about ethnomusicology. I know I did. Have a great day today and be good, guys. I'll see you soon.
Hey guys, this is Jim Gavin here coming at you from the Key of Awesome Music podcast. This installment is all about being open to the quote-unquote muse and letting it flow through you. In order to do this, you have to show up every day, even if you don't want to. This can be the hardest part and is, in fact, most people's stumbling block or wall. Consider the definitions of the word first. Muse. Any of the nine daughters of Zeus and Mnemosyne. Not exactly sure how to pronounce that. It's Greek mythology presiding over song and poetry and the arts and sciences. There's a few of them. Calliope, which is epic poetry. Clio, history. Erato, love, poetry and lyric art. Euterp, which is music, especially flute. Melporene, which is tragedy. Polymnia, hymns. Terpsichore, which is dance, Thalia, comedy, and Urania, which is astronomy. So, of course, we're going to be focusing on Euterp, which is music. And she's portrayed with an ancient Greek musical instrument like a flute called an oulos. A-U-L-O-S is the spelling of it. And she's donning panpipes and a laurel wreath. She's been called the giver of delight by ancient poets. Some people believe that she invented that instrument I talked about, the oulos, which is A-U-L-O-S, or the double flute. Though most mythographers credit Marias or Athena with its invention. Some say she also invented other wind instruments. That's pretty cool. According to the traditions and beliefs of the ancient Greek, musicians would invoke the aid of Euterp to inspire, guide, and assist them in their composition. So it's kind of like praying to something or somebody in order to help them out and sort of to draw that inspiration to be able to work on what they wanted to work on and create what they wanted to create. This would often take the form of a prayer for divine inspiration from the minor goddess. Along with her sister muses, Euterp was believed to have lived on Mount Olympus, where she and her sisters entertained their father and the other Olympian gods, so to speak, with their great artistry. Moving on, we're going to go to Polymnia now and kind of touch upon her. Her name means one of many hymns, specifically the muse of religious hymns, and portrayed as a woman in a pensive or meditative pose, very serious. She presided over lyric poetry and was believed to have invented the lyre, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with what that is. A lyre is spelled L-Y-R-E, not the one like liar, liar, pants on fire. That's a different spelling, totally different meaning. A lyre, L-Y-R-E, is a stringed instrument like a small U-shaped harp with strings fixed to a crossbar, used especially in ancient Greece. Modern instruments of this type are found mainly in East Africa. She's often holding a finger to her mouth, dressed in a long cloak and veil, and resting her elbow on a pillar. Polymnia is also sometimes credited as being the muse of geometry and meditation. Polymnia, because by her great pole, which is the first part of the word, praises, humanesis. She brings distinction to writers whose works have won for them immortal fame. So that's like the first real definition that shows up as one of the nine muses in ancient Greek history. There's other
definitions as well, so we'll touch upon them. So the second one is to become absorbed in thought, especially to think about something carefully and thoroughly. The third one is wonder or marvel. And the fourth one is a source of inspiration, which is kind of along the lines of the first one. It's no wonder that this is where people have trouble, because in its definition, muse is a source of inspiration. But what if inspiration doesn't just come naturally? What if you have to put yourself into situations that draw inspiration from them? Showing up every day to the office, so to speak, whatever that really looks like for you, putting the time, effort, and energy in, if you do this day in and day out, you will inevitably create good habits and find ways to minimize unproductive time, therefore maximizing your time and being efficient, effective, and productive. But it's not always the case, right? And its most basic form, nature ought to do that for us as well. Anytime you're in nature, there's something special about it. You just know there is. The silence, the stillness, the calm, peaceful way the animals move, the water flows, and the leaves fall. Seeing a waterfall, catching a sunrise or a sunset or a rainbow with vivid colors. Looking at a mountain, sometimes it's as if you can't tell where the earth ends and where heaven begins. They're all perfect examples of nature taking its course in you. Now, to some people, this might sound awesome, but to others, it might sound like a lot of wasted time and energy. Why would I do something that might not bear fruit? That doesn't make sense, right? But I challenge you to think of it as a whole, though. Even though it might not bear fruit in the short term, it will bear fruit in the long term. Life is a marathon, not a sprint. It's a famous quote. It's playing the long game rather than a get-rich-quick scheme that you see of those all over the internet lately. Sometimes you have to put time and energy into something you might not want to, or into something that might not appear to be fruitful at first. However, if you were to pull back the layers, opportunities have several levels to them. Yes, there are risks, but isn't that what life is all about? Taking chances and making the most of the situations and running with opportunities that come our way? At least being open to opportunities and considering them as an option or route to take. But I digress. Back to muses. In addition to giving us inspiration, they leave us with energy and the sense of wanting more. At least this is the case for me. This is why when you hear someone say they want to stay in the zone for as long as possible because they don't know when the zone, quote unquote, will come back again, I've experienced this firsthand with writing and recording songs. I lose all track of time, and it is in this lost sense of time where I've been able to find myself most, believe it or not. I mean, how am I able to play several instruments without ever learning how to read music and sing in different voices, layering vocal melodies and harmonies? It's allowing the muse in and letting her work her magic in me, so to speak. Not fighting it, but welcoming it. And not worrying about anything else and just being 100% in the moment also really, really helps a lot. So muse, keep on coming. Muse, be with me for as long as you'd like. Muse, help me create beauty and become a better version of myself. Muse, muse, muse. And that's it for today, guys. Let me know what you think about this topic. I'd love to dig in a little bit deeper with it. I did a little bit of research on it and found some neat stuff. And it just kind of reaffirms what I've been doing on my course and my path with using music as a tool to help people and sort of letting the muse come to me and the inspiration come and in many different forms of being able to use music as a tool to help people. So that's it for today, guys. I hope you enjoy this installment of Muses and it's inspired you to be open to allowing the muse to find you. And when she does, to embrace and run with it. This is Jim Gavin signing off from the Key of Awesome Music Podcast. Have a great day, guys.